What I want to, I'm just going to talk very briefly about a couple of climate change issues and then go forward. As you can see from this picture from the IPCC, the pace of climate change is increasing. It's largely due to carbon dioxide. Even in this year, which is sort of down worldwide, we had an increase in total carbon dioxide concentration. When I started working on this, it was about 340 parts per million in about 1985. Today it's 394. So we've gone up about 2 parts per million every year. And this has some dire consequences for a number of things that we do. Now, if we ever want to stop this rise, what we eventually have to do is reach a point where we stabilize our emissions. And U.S. emissions are close to 20 tons per capita per person, and we need to get down to about 1 ton in order to stabilize the emissions. So what that basically means is on a global scale, we don't want to have China and India and those countries' emissions come up to our levels, but rather our levels have to drop to the levels in Africa in terms of net emissions. So we really have to change the energy economy and sequester quite a bit more if we're ever going to get to this level. Now, in terms of climate change, there are 3 decisions. There's the decision that historically has been to do not very much. And under those circumstances, we probably face maximum damages from climate change. There's a decision to mitigate, which is what I think this session is about, where we try to restrict our emissions to the atmosphere. And there's the decision to adapt, where we learn to produce better under hotter conditions. And I actually think in the short run, we'd better stop asking about carbon cap and trade markets. They aren't going to happen. And we better figure out how we can adapt and increase soil carbon at the same time. Globally, agriculture is a relatively small part of emissions. I think it's 13%, 13.5% from total agriculture and about 17% from forestry, so about 30%. The soil part of that's relatively small at the moment, although according to a picture that was done, about 25% of the increase in atmospheric concentration from pre-industrial times was due to clearing land. So it's largely due to carbon sequestration in soils and in standing vegetation. So from a policy implementation standpoint, then, we can have no policy, which is sort of what U.S. policy was 10 years ago. They were going to wait for more science. Cap and trade, which has had a lot of discussion but politically hasn't gotten anywhere and doesn't appear to get anywhere in the next 5 or 6 years. We can start to do taxation on emissions. I don't think that's probably in the cards at the moment. EPA can implement its stationary source regulations. I was part of the team designing the accounting scheme for that, and carbon sequestration would be in part of that thing. And then under the Farm Bill, we can have something like opt-in policy, which is we may have some Farm Bill incentives for people to participate in carbon sequestration activities. If they do, though, they have to take the full liability of that. So many people in the agricultural industry only want carbon sequestration on a leasing basis. After 10 years, no further obligations. The opt-in policy, if implemented, probably wouldn't allow that. Once you went in and took the payments, you'd have to take the liability if you reversed the carbon sequestration. Now, if we are going to get into carbon sequestration, and in fact, if at some point we do get a cap and trade, there's some issues with respect to soil carbon sequestration, which is a word called fungibility. The simple definition of the word is having grades of different assets. So when you go to a gas station and you buy high octane, or what do they call it, premium and regular, you pay a different amount for that. Well, what I'm anticipating is at some point you may end up getting a different price for some sorts of sequestration activities than you do for some other non-sequestration activities. In particular, if we somehow stop nitrous oxide from being emitted into the atmosphere, once we've stopped it, it's gone forever. However, if we put sequestration into the soil, it's there until perhaps the practice is reversed. So in one case, for a buyer, you know it can never come back on you. In the other case, you know it could. Anyhow, we have lots of grading standards illustrated in the agricultural sector. People get a price premium, and additionality, leakage, and uncertainty may well cause a price discount for agricultural soils. The first issue is saturation. Basically, once the land use has changed to, say, a minimum till type of operation, you get a gain in that tillage for perhaps 20 years, 20 or 25 years. This is a picture from Weston Post on what happened over time with gains. At that point, then, you reach some kind of a new equilibrium and you don't continue. Same thing happens on the forestry side. There, it takes 70 or 80 years. What this basically means, then, is that a firm buying from someone some carbon offsets will not get a constant increment. They'll get an increment that goes up and then reaches a stabilization point, but could come back if the land is plowed. This may well lead to some discounts. When I looked at a 25-year lease at the end of 25 years where there was no obligation, the willingness to pay would only be about 50%. If beyond that you had to pay the farmer $5 an acre to stay in that tillage, then they'd be willing to pay only about 36% of what they'd pay for a methane emission that was permanent. In forestry, depending on how things go, you can see different kinds of discounts. Well, I guess that was a 36% discount and a 49% discount. So they would pay 64% if they had to do the maintenance at $5 an acre. We looked at this in East Texas at a number of different possibilities involved in switching out of rice production, and we found permanence discounts between 10 and 50%, an additionality discount, meaning that the practice wouldn't have already happened, between 1 and 10%, a leakage discount, and this means the international land responses in places like Brazil of 16 to 30%, and an uncertainty discount about 10%, meaning you'd only get between 35 and 67% of a normal price under those circumstances. So to me, it looks like sale is not such a great possibility at the moment. Between the policy, the fungibility, and prices in the U.S., a few years ago, everybody was happily tracking the Chicago Climate Exchange, who went bankrupt about a year ago. And so we don't have carbon trading on a national basis. We do have some carbon trading schemes in California and New England, although I'm not quite sure to what extent soils have gotten into those. I think they're not terribly active in trades quite yet. So I think some different technological mechanisms need to be thought about how to get around some of these issues. I wrote a paper with Mac Post and a few others, and they talked about biotechnology and plant breeding to make roots go deeper, to stick the soil further, stick the carbon further down. But we also could use something like biochar, where we process the agricultural crops into energy sources and at the same time get a charcoal byproduct, and then some other forms of deep soil sequestration. We did some work on biochar to take a look at what would happen if you put corn stalks into biochar and then through pyrolysis turned it into electricity and greenhouse gas offsets. We ended up finding that the sequestration part of this was relatively minor, that net greenhouse gas effect down toward the bottom. The real question when it came to the economics was how much was the energy worth? And notice if you use fast pyrolysis, which generates very little biochar, you get a lot of energy value. If you use slow pyrolysis, you don't get very much. Now, when we looked at this, the greenhouse gas benefits under the Chicago Climate Exchange price of about $4 a ton were $3 to $4, very minor. We did look at this under European prices and found that fast pyrolysis was marginally profitable there. And we looked at it again in Taiwan, where energy prices were a lot higher, and you could make money off of the prospect at that point. Here, it would clearly have to be subsidized with these prices in mind. There's still a problem, too, with transactions costs. In particular, a 100-megawatt power plant would want to purchase a large lot of carbon, basically somewhere around 100,000 tons. An average farmer in carbon terms generates about a quarter of a ton an acre, so you need to cover 400,000 acres, which means roughly 1,000 farmers in an association. Crop insurers get 25%, keep 25% of the money as brokers when people come to insure their crops. Minnesota Water Quality keeps 50%. There'd be a large role for brokers. That would also create a substantial price difference between what a power plant paid and what a farmer received. So, other policies. Well, the stationary source policy may offer some possibilities. The EPA was sued, I think, by Massachusetts and some other states, and the Supreme Court held that they needed to regulate greenhouse gases in societal interests. So right now they're thinking about regulating them, and they're designing an accounting system for how much greenhouse gases are offset when you burn bioenergy. And part of that involves soil carbon sequestration. That may offer some possibilities. And then the opt-in policy may well. That's what USDA is thinking about. And finally, there's adaptation, and that's where I think a lot of science work is needed to be looked at. Basically, this is a chart from the last IPCC report, and it shows that if we want to stabilize at roughly 450 parts per million, which was the European goal up until about 2 years ago when they abandoned it, because this year we're going to pass 450 parts per million when you take nitrous oxide and methane into account, we would have to peak our emissions by 2015. Now, that picture showed no sign of emissions peaking, really. And by 2020, they would have to revert back to 2000 levels. For me, I think that's unlikely. I think we're going to head for 700 parts per million long before we get this problem under control. And that means we're looking at 3 to 4 degrees Celsius of temperature increase. I wouldn't want to be in College Station, Texas in the summer with another 4 degrees Celsius. It was bad enough this summer anyhow. Was that you telling me to quit soon? No? Okay. is that my last chart? Or is this thing doing this something strange? So if we want to talk about adaptation, what we need to talk about is how we can produce agriculture better in a hotter arena. That means that we need substantial research on drought-resistant varieties, new irrigation practices, tolerant livestock breeds, tolerant plant varieties. In Texas, by 2080, if climate change proceeds, we're supposed to reach a point where the drought of record is actually average conditions, meaning this year, which is perhaps going to be the drought of record, it's drier at the moment than the drought of record. If we're going to produce under those conditions, we need to figure out ways to do that. What can we do with salt-tolerant crops, etc.? Also changing crop and livestock mix. We're seeing more corn in North Dakota than we ever did. Cotton is starting to creep north. Also, there's substantial land moving out of the cropland inventory and into the pasture inventory, and the stocking rates are going down. So we need to work on these various kinds of adaptation mechanisms in order to improve our ability to produce under those. So the grand challenge is, how can we increase sequestration without direct payments? I don't know if that's possible. Perhaps the stationary source of the opt-in will make it happen if there's not really a market. Perhaps we can figure out how to do biochar on a large scale basis as a byproduct of energy, get something like the biochar, which is a stable charcoal that can be apparently buried in the soil and therefore never have a saturation issue. Perhaps we can do this along with adaptation. If we do get payments, then how can we reduce the permanence and uncertainty issues? Because firms are not going to be quite as readily interested in coming to paying a farmer and say, okay, I'll pay you for the next 10 years, and at the end of 10 years, I have to go find offsets from somebody else because you won't promise to deliver them anymore. And also the uncertainty issue, where the real question is, when you contract with somebody, will you in fact get everything that you paid for from a energy business? So I guess it's not real consistent with the theme of the rest of the thing, because I just think there's some major implementation policies and we really need to start thinking about working on the adaptation side in terms of carbon. So I'm ahead, right? How much ahead am I?
About 8 minutes.
So you can throw things at me or I can quietly leave.
Interesting talk. Just one question, which in a way goes back to a question for the last talk. You know, you've talked about sort of payments for carbon and sequestration and so on, which is, you know, one thing. But what about, are people in your field thinking a bit about payments for practices that will cut nitrous oxide emissions? Because you might get, you know, if the effect ratio is so great, this might be more effective.
Well, there's such a thing as a trading ratio, and basically what's happened in a lot of parts of the world is that we take either 296 or 310 for nitrous oxide and pay for those. There's a big debate in my part of the world on how you can effectively mobilize farmers to do things. And in particular, I'm fairly naive on nitrous oxide, so I'm now going to say some things I don't really know much about. But I've worked with Steve Ogle and Keith Postian and those guys at NREL a lot on nitrous oxide, but I don't know how the heck you could ever monitor it. You're just kind of going to have to kind of guess at what's coming off. So people talk about taxing fertilizer, but the problem with that is it's not targeted to the source of the emissions, because one person may be doing something on a kind of soil that generates a lot more emissions than another, and you're not directly targeting. And that's been a historic problem. In the 90s, when we were paying for soil erosion, I heard a talk from some guy, I guess it was in the 80s, that said that 90% of the money we spent to control soil erosion was spent on property that didn't have a soil erosion problem. We saw the same sort of thing with CRP, where we retargeted it after a few years. We did find some interesting results from, what do they call that, nitrification inhibitors, in terms of the amount of nitrous oxide that it might be able to reduce. But Basically, USDA and a lot of other agencies are kind of at a loss about how they can directly get to affecting the practices where emissions are really affected. And so society as a whole, you know, when we talk about managing pollution problems, we've been quite successful at managing point source pollution problems at an electricity plant. But the remaining pollution problem we haven't really captured is the non-point problem in terms of even managing fertilizer emissions into the Mississippi, which affects the dead zone. You know, I don't know what we're going to do about that. We've talked about it a lot, but having a winning strategy, heck no, we don't have one of those. What I did, if you see the small print, and if you see the small print at the bottom, which you can read later, it's a couple of papers on this that have these things calculated. What we did is we took a, quote, perfect offset. So one fairly perfect offset is capturing manure from capturing methane from a manure lagoon, running it through an electrical generator, and destroying it, because clearly you're not going to have that emission, versus looking at the emission if something happens. And basically think about the following. If I tell you I will let you drive my car, or well, here's this car and it's yours and you have a particular price, and then I tell you I'll give you the car on a 5-year lease and at the end you have to give it back to me, would you be willing to pay the same amount for a car in both cases? And the answer probably is no, I wouldn't be willing to pay the same amount because it has residual value at that point. Well, that's the point of this 25-year lease with 100% buyback. You come to a power plant and you say, I will sell you a carbon offset for the next 20 years. And at the end of that, I want to be able to do whatever I can so there's no obligation beyond that. They're going to be willing to pay somewhere about 50% of what they would pay for this methane you destroy, and they know it can never come back on them. It's a mathematical thing. The one in the numerator, the perfect one in the denominator, and then look at the ratio.
Any other questions? Yes.
As are we on the, along with the increase of the conversion steps,
Conversion steps to what?
Just like the bio-residues to bio-chaff, residues to bio-energy. There was a lot of the energy losses
increases
into the during the conversion process.
Well, corn ethanol is supposedly about 20 to 25.
Have you finished the question?
No.
Oh, okay.
What do you think of the future of by the application of biochar to sequester carbon?
Okay. Is that it now? Okay. Well, as I interpret it, is can we make the biochar, and what do I think the future prospects are for using it?
Yes.
Is that about right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what you have to do to make biochar is heat a piece of plant material to 3,000 degrees in 3 seconds or something about like that. That's the fast pyrolysis. The slow pyrolysis is you heat it over a day. The biochar is the residual charcoal left after this heating has occurred. I think there's still some technological issues. I usually make the biochar people mad at me when I start talking about things like this, but there was a company in Canada that loaded up a truck with biochar and started driving it out to the fields, and it only took them 5 days to put the fire out. So there's some problems that you're bringing this warm, combustible stuff that really is almost equivalent to charcoal, or quite hot combustible stuff, and handling issues. We'll probably be able to get a hold of that, but it's probably going to be fairly costly to do. The net energy balance looks positive because you can get substantial electrical energy and or this biofuel stuff. You can use about half the biochar to provide the heat source. So under those circumstances, and it does fairly well. The problem is everybody in the soil science community wants slow biochar, but you only get about one quarter slow pyrolysis. You get about one quarter as much energy, and sorry to say, energy is going to drive the process, not the biochar. From an overall technological standpoint, it has a major problem with feedstock.